and this is WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. My name is David Karpoff, and with me now in the studio is Mr. Anthony Cave Brown, who is a British historical writer and journalist who has written several books now dealing with intelligence matters deriving from World War II. His preeminent work, Bodyguard of Lies, was published last November by Harper and Row. And in recent publication, The Secret War Report of the OSS, which Mr. Brown was instrumental in getting declassified. And you just mentioned before we went on that you had to apply through the CIA.
Yes, the Central Intelligence Agency is the custodian of all documentation relating to the Office of Strategic Services, because, of course, the Office of Strategic Services is the both the godfather and the godmother of the CIA as we know it today.
So that not only some of the documentation from the OSS has fallen into the protection of the CIA, but actually a lot of the personnel from the OSS went into the CIA.
Until fairly recently, the hierarchy of the Central Intelligence Agency was almost wholly former officers of the Office of Strategic Services. You see, what happened was that the OSS, under a variety of names, was formed in about 1941-42, and it existed until Donovan, Wild Bill Donovan, that most legendary and colourful character, was fired by the War Department General Staff in 1945. They didn't want him around any longer because he was...
Was that after the end of the war?
Yes, just at about the end of the war, when America was looking forward to the police, to the peace, and so the OSS was disbanded, and there were a variety of organisations. One was called the Strategic Services Unit. The other one was called the Central Intelligence Board. Out of those two organizations in 48 came the CIA, largely with the same personnel, certainly with the same structure, and of course wholly with the same attitude as existed during World War II.
And that was due mostly to Truman, I believe, deciding that the it was getting out of hand and there should be some central umbrella organization.
Yes, no. The whole American attitude toward intelligence in peacetime stemmed, of course, from Pearl Harbor. If there had been a Central Intelligence Board or a Central Intelligence Agency in 1941, it's very unlikely that Pearl Harbor would ever have happened. There was ample evidence that the Japanese main fleet was at sea in a variety of different places in Washington. But there was no central place at which all the reports could be evaluated by a single desk, by a single individual, and who could report directly to the president. None of these reports in themselves indicated that the main fleet was at sea, but all of them, when put together, certainly indicated that, but they were never put together. And America took that lesson very much to its heart and decided that when the OSS had outlived its usefulness, that... there must be a Central Intelligence Board where the director and various other people could report to a central organization such as the National Security Council. It's a complex... actually, well, people think it's complex. Actually, it's a good deal more wieldy than most of these intelligence-governmental relationships. The fact is that the CIA today... has a direct line of communication through to the president, and the president has a direct line of communication through to the CIA, and the same applies, of course, between George Bush and Henry Kissinger. There's very much two-way traffic there. The CIA has become very much a part of both policy and statecraft in the United States of America, largely, of course, because of the experiences during World War II, and particularly because of the experiences that they had during the early days of intelligence work in this country, which, of course, was the OSS.
Well, of course, the European powers had a long tradition of intelligence services going back just years and years and
years.
Well,
it goes back, in the British case, to Walsingham, of course, back in the days of Queen Elizabeth I. Walsingham founded the first secret intelligence service of modern times. There's always been spies, there have always been saboteurs, there have always been intriguers. But there have never been a consolidated central bureau for the acquisition and dissemination of intelligence. That was one of the ways in which, of course, the British managed to found and then to hold on to a world empire for so long because of the excellence of their intelligence service. And of course it was the British that in World War II, just before the Americans came into it, who advised Donovan and Roosevelt about how to found, how to create a bureaucracy, right, the type of personnel, and particularly how to finance a secret intelligence service.
So previous to the foundation of the OSS, the United States didn't have a single intelligence agency of this type?
No, it did not. It had a variety of intelligence services. Of course, the FBI, in a sense, is an intelligence service, a counterintelligence service. Then you had the naval and military intelligence services, which operated through the attaches on a worldwide scale. But that was a very rough and ready organization. In fact, it practically wasn't an organization at all, because the military intelligence service in the United States of America was in a constant state of being broke. The naval intelligence people were better funded. Then, of course, there's always the State Department, which is, in certain respects, an intelligence-gathering mm-hmm. organization. But to say that any form of central board or central organization existed until the foundation of the OSS would be quite wrong.
Well, all of a sudden you find yourself in a war.
Yes.
You don't have a single intelligence set up. You don't have a historical tradition of the kind that European countries had in the way of intelligence services. How does one go about setting up an intelligence agency? Who do you go to?
Well, of course, intelligence is very much the business of gentlemen. I mean, you don't go to the coal miners to establish one. You don't go to the automobile workers. You don't go to the railroad workers. Of course, you go to the Ivy League people, because they usually have the sort of background that an intelligence hierarchy is expected to have. They usually come from the ruling classes. They do in the case of the Soviet Union. They certainly do in the case of France and Great Britain. And in this case, of course, this is precisely what they did. I mean, Donovan went to all his buddies in the law, in the banks, and the universities. And that's how...
Now, is this because they had the right kind of abilities, or because they could be counted on to think in the correct manner?
Well, no. I mean, it follows that if you're successful in business or industry, it's usual that you can apply your immense talents in another direction if you have to. And it also follows that those types of people have a bureaucratic background, a capacity to establish a bureau or an organization in quite a hurry. They have to do so for every day as part of their trade. And it follows that they could do so every day for the purposes of government. But more particularly, the Ivy League universities tend to produce a breed of men whose capacities in wartime, at least when unleashed by the tolerances of war, permit them to do all sorts of extraordinary things that they wouldn't ordinarily do. As I've just said, intelligence is the business of gentlemen and has been in the European countries for three or four centuries. And it was natural that Donovan should choose his own kind. First of all, he can trust them. Secondly, he can manipulate them. And thirdly, they talk with the correct accents. They know how to sign their names correctly. They know how to spend money correctly. They know a good deal about the world. They know a good deal about, in this case, they knew a great deal about the character and personality of Hitler, his governmental system, his aspirations. They'd learned all this. All it meant was that the hierarchy of the United States got together and produced an intelligence service. And it's not as complicated a business as one would expect. All it means is that you've coordinated all the intelligence gathering activities of a country, the press, the radio, as it was in those days, the industry, the diplomacy. And you've formed a system whereby that intelligence can be brought together, can be evaluated, tested for its accuracy, and then you've also formed a channel by which the more important than anything else is, of course, its dissemination, to make sure that information reaches the right hands as quickly mm-hmm. as possible.
Well, of course, one of the biggest flaps about the CIA now is the complaint that Colby and other CIA people have voiced to the public many times, is that the public doesn't realize that the CIA is really a dual organization, that in the public mind the CIA is only going out and performing burglaries and assassinations and so on and so forth, and the public doesn't realize that so much of their activities involves just simple gathering of information on a strictly open and above board basis.
Yes, I think it's perfectly true to say. I mean, I think that William Colby, a man who I admire very much, I think that if there are more Americans like him, then the country might find itself in a great deal less trouble. But the fact is this, that I'm quite prepared to believe that 75% of an intelligence services organizations are quite overt and above board. But they have to have a capacity for covert operations, because you never know when you're going to find yourself in a covert situation. It's not unpredictable. If we knew when... If any country knew when it was going to get itself into a dangerous or difficult situation, then you wouldn't need an intelligence service. You need an intelligence service for precisely that point, to divine when times are going to get tough and difficult, and when you need special measures to protect the Constitution and the realm, which is what an intelligence service exists to do, of course.
So the SSS was organized along...
Which one? The SS?
The OSS.
OSS.
Was organized along the same way of... just monitoring communications and
yes,
stuff.
Yes, now
like
here's
a point.
That
a covert.
Yes, you see,
office.
What they did was they didn't want an intelligence service like Great Britain. The British, the OSS derived from the British intelligence services. What they didn't want was the British split their intelligence services up into three or four different branches. One was responsible for special operations. Whenever you see the word special, by the way, assume that it has a sinister connotation, because it does. Special means something special. And it usually is a euphemism for something which is relatively nasty by peacetime terms, anyway. But the British had one organization for special operations. They had another one for secret intelligence. They had another one, a specialist organization for propaganda, political warfare. They had a fourth organization for escape and evasion within enemy territory, which was a very large industry at the end of the war. They had a fifth organization for deception. You see, they had all these bureaus, the American idea was that that one central organization controlling all these activities could function very much more effectively than a variety of smaller organizations spread right throughout the apparatus of government. In that respect, I think the Americans were wrong. The OSS did not function any more effectively or any more efficiently. And it certainly didn't cancel out the tendency, which always exists with secret bureau, to fight within themselves. They're always tussling and arguing and trying to gain preeminence. Mm-hmm. And the OSS did not find that the experience was that there was, in fact, the usual trouble between various departments, as one usually found between various organizations. The simple fact is that the OSS really entered the war too late, or became a bureau which could be entrusted with special operations far too late to really influence the course of the war. In the British case, of course, where they were operational from long before the war, they did have a very, very definite and effective influence on operations. I mean, for example, this whole business of ULTRA, the question of the code breaking, the breaking of the German code. Yes, of course. I mean, the whole history of the war, the whole strategy and tactics of that war were definitely and positively influenced at all times by the existence of ULTRA. But the OSS did have a strong influence in the latter part of the war in Europe. It had no influence at all in Southeast Asia or in the Pacific, because MacArthur didn't want them there, in the Pacific area, and the British wouldn't let them into or any great strength into the Southeast Asian theatre. So that their main area of operations was the Balkans and Southeastern Europe and Central Europe. They were particularly effective in Germany itself. Alan Dulles in Bern, for example, did a quite remarkable job of infiltrating the German system right up to the top. He had agents quite close to Hitler.
Mm-hmm. That raises the other question. What about penetration in the other direction? The German intelligence
operations against America
were extremely Byzantine. There was a lot of competition between the different services. How far did they succeed in infiltration?
You only got to look at the French collapse to see how effective the German intelligence services were. But from 1940 onwards, from the time that Britain retreated into the island, and their main triumph was in counterintelligence work. They were extremely effective in Europe. I mean, they held
catching,
down... neutralizing British and American and Russian, for that matter, intelligence operations, catching their agents, and usually trying to turn the agents around and use them against the hostile powers. They were extremely effective there. They were also extremely effective in ordinary routine, what I call police work, that is controlling the subject countries. I mean, they held them down to a remarkable degree. The only place where they really had trouble, they had some trouble, considerable trouble in Poland, where you would expect them to have trouble. They had a lot of trouble in Russia, but on a limited scale. And they also, had very serious trouble indeed in Yugoslavia. But in France and the Western European countries in general, they managed to maintain a high degree of control, so much so that Mayor Dietring, who was Field Marshal von Rundstedt's chief of intelligence during the invasion period of the Second World War, the German army commander in the West, tells me that the French resistance at no time was ever a factor in any of the German military plannings or reactions to various Allied military operations. So in short, the Germans were especially good at that time of work. Where they were very weak, and this goes back to a very large extent to the personality of the chief of German intelligence, who was a man called Admiral Canaris, who's one of the great mysteries of modern history, who he was really working for. There are a number of stories which suggest that, in point of fact, his allegiances lay with Britain. There are other stories which suggest that his allegiances lay with the United States of America, especially with Alan Dulles. That Canaris was, in fact, politicking to take over the Third Reich and turn it against the Soviet Union with British and American backing. These stories are only stories. There's a fair amount of proof to show that quite acceptable proof historically to show that he was thoroughly disloyal to Hitler and thoroughly loyal to Germany.
Well, certainly there's immense proof. I mean, there's all kinds of different groups and that were maneuvering to turn Germany to form an alliance between Germany and the Western powers against the Soviet Union.
Yes,
saw that as some kind of salvation for
now,
Germany.
This is what I was driving at. Therefore, Canaris's organization was extremely effective in Spain and Portugal, where it really counted. Extremely effective against the Russians, very ineffective against the United States of America, very ineffective against Great Britain. And this suggests the policy to me, rightly or wrongly.
It was done by choice.
I beg your pardon?
It was done by choice.
It was calculation, certainly, yes. There were certainly quite close links between General Menges, who was head of the British service. All this comes out in Bodyguard of Lies, that's the secret history of D-Day. There was certainly close connection over the D-Day period between Admiral Canaris and General Menges of the British Secret Intelligence Service, and also between Admiral Canaris and Alan Dulles. And one can see Alan Dulles's spoon stirring the broth very heavily at the time of the July 20 bomb plot against the life of Hitler.
Dulles, of course, was in Switzerland for
He was a Bern. He was the OSS chief in Central Europe. And, of course, subsequently became director of the Central Intelligence Agency. All in all, neither the Japanese nor the Germans were particularly effective, and certainly the Italians were rarely effective, at any stage after the first initial shock of the war. Once we'd overcome that, and once our own counterintelligence and intelligence organizations were on a war footing, they very rarely ever succeeded in doing very much. They did a very good job against the Americans. The Germans did this. In southeastern Europe and the Balkans, there was a terrific catastrophe, which is related in the OSS war report, quite candidly and openly, in which the Germans managed to infiltrate and then stood